Now, as you take a look at the survey of Lutheranism in America today, I think one of the things that you might want to begin with in looking at very briefly, I'm going to spend a little more time with that later on, would be the charts that you have received. Why don't we begin with the yellow one? This is identified as the American Lutheran Church. And you will notice that what I have done here is to indicate when the oldest component part of the American Lutheran Church had been organized. So that you see in the upper left, 1818, Ohio Synod. And then if you follow that line, you'll find that by 1930, over on the right side, there is the ALC, that's the first American Lutheran Church that had been formed through a merger of the Buffalo Synod, which had been established in 1845, the Iowa Synod of 54, Texas Synod of 51. Now, if you move over to the right side, you'll see that that American Lutheran Church became a part of the new American Lutheran Church, which was formed in 1960. Now, the rest also shows you what kind of previous Lutheran organizations went into the formation of the American Lutheran Church. Now, the American Lutheran Church is that church body which is headed by Dr. David Preuss, who is a cousin of President J.E.O. Preuss of the Missouri Synod. I think that the American Lutheran Church probably in most of its history has sort of been considered a rather close cousin of the Missouri Synod. There are many, many things that the Missouri Synod and the American Lutheran Church have in common because of their previous background history. We want to touch upon those from time to time. Now, the second, the goldenrod form, is entitled the Lutheran Church in America. Often this is referred to as the LCA, ALC, LCA. You notice that the earliest church listed here is the General Synod of 1820. Now, actually, the oldest component part of the Lutheran Church in America is a group that was known as the Pennsylvania Ministerium, organized as early as 1748. So it's a Lutheran church body that was formed long before the Revolutionary War. But again, it's an indication to assist you to see how many different parts went into the formation of the Lutheran Church in America, which was organized in 1962. Now, the green one, I will not say too much about that, but I thought it might be of interest to you to have it. This is not an organization today, but it is a collection which I have entitled Lutheran Organizations, primarily of Norwegian extraction. So you can see that the Norwegian Lutherans in America had formed a lot of different organizations. They had merged, they separated, they re-merged, and so forth. Basically, most Norwegian Lutherans today are in the American Lutheran Church. That's your yellow slip, or your yellow chart. So most of what you find on the green is part of the American Lutheran Church today. Now, having said that much, I think one could also mention that as far as the Missouri Synod is concerned, and I didn't give you a chart, because there really is no chart necessary. The Missouri Synod was organized in 1847, and it has had about that kind of a history. It is not the product of the mergers as the American Lutheran Church and the LCA are. The Missouri Synod has a single line growth. Now, you can add some in here. There was, for example, a group of the Ohio Synod, which broke away from the Ohio Synod and joined the Missouri Synod. There was another group that came from the Buffalo Synod, broke away from the Buffalo Synod and joined the Missouri Synod. But These are not mergers of the type that you see in the American Lutheran Church and in the LCA. Then there is also the English Synod, which became the English District in 1911. Now, there are additions of that type. I think in one way in which you can look at it is that the Missouri Synod would have a picture of the Mississippi River, a little beginning way up near Bemidji, Minnesota, getting bigger as it flows, a little beginning right in here that you could almost walk across. 4,000 people were involved, 4,000 communicant members at the time the Missouri Synod was formed in 1847. Now that is the largest congregation in the Missouri Synod today, has more than 4,000 members. So it's a small little, tiny little stream like the Mississippi River. You can walk across very, very easily. But as time goes on, it gets bigger. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger until when you look at the Mississippi down at New Orleans, or even if you look at it only here in St. Louis, you see that it is a mighty big stream. Now, little streams, sometimes a little rivulet or a creek or something has flown into that stream, into the big Mississippi River. With the other Lutheran church bodies, the LCA and the ALC particularly, you really end up with a lot of rivulets forming, sometimes running parallel, an additional group entering a merger, and then another big stream comes in, as I hope you can see from these charts. Now that is more the picture of the LCA and the ALC. And the reason I'm stressing this is when you look at the literature that is being distributed in newspapers today, for example, or Time, or Newsweek, you will normally hear that the Lutheran Church in America is the largest Lutheran body. And so it is. It has more members than the Missouri Synod. But what people always forget is that it is the product of a lot of synods that have merged, whereas the Missouri Synod is not a product of a lot of mergers. And I think this is something that as we look at the beginnings, that we ought to take into consideration. We're dealing here with a different kind of a situation. When you speak of the American Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church in America, and the Missouri Synod, you're not speaking about parallel organizations. You're not talking about the three sons in one family, for example. But you're talking about, in the LCA and the ALC particularly, you're talking about a family reunion where there are, in the Lutheran Church in America, for example, it is quite possible that there are some 150 synods that have flown into the LCA, of which the Missouri Synod could have been one. Now, it's that kind of contrast, I think, that is important as we try to understand the Missouri Synod past and present. Comments on this? Any questions? If not, then let's take a very, very quick look at the beginning of Lutheranism in America. By 1847, when the Missouri Synod was formed, there had been an awful lot of Lutherans in America, and there had been an awful lot of Lutheran history in America as well. I think one of the point stopping off places where we ought to peek in at least is 1619, 1620. Did you know that there were Lutherans in North America in 1619, 1620? There are very, very few people who are aware of that. During the bicentennial, I don't really think that I heard much of these Danish Lutherans at all. Now, who were these people? They were a group of Danish members of the Royal Navy of Denmark. They were looking for a northwest passage into India. You remember from your American history courses that, or European history, that there were a lot of people in 1600 who were looking for a shortcut by sea to get into India so that particularly North Europe would get a hold of the spices and all the other good things that could be exported from India. Now, the Danish government around this period of time was very plucky with a rather huge navy, exploring almost like the old Vikings, getting back on the oceans and engaged in a lot of exploration and even with some imperialism. Now, the story goes that there were two Danish sea captains who were very anxious to be the first Danish navy men who would find the Northwest Passage, or to find a shortcut to India. One of these captains went through the normal routes around Africa and then up into Asia. The other one, whose name was Jens Munk, got the assignment of trying to get through northern Canada. Remember a couple of years ago, I think it was the submarine Nautilus that finally was able to get through from the Atlantic Ocean all the way across Canada into the Pacific Ocean. This is what Jens Munk was trying to seek. So he got into Port Churchill in the Hudson Bay area. Now that's pretty far north. And he got that far with two little vessels about the size of the ships that Columbus used to get into North America. And in early September already, it got so cold up there that they realized that they could not move any farther. The glaciers, the ice chunks, the wind, the hurricanes, the snowstorms, everything was getting so wild in early September that they decided they were going to have their winter quarters in this place near Port Churchill, Canada. They fastened the two ships. They tried to prepare for winter, but they just had not been prepared for all of this. Even their clothing wasn't set up to endure such bitter cold, because they thought that by the time winter comes, they're going to be in India. They didn't make it. They had a Lutheran pastor on board ship by the name of Rasmus Jansen. Rasmus Jansen provided spiritual services, and he has the honor of being the first Lutheran clergyman to officiate in North America. He also conducted the first Christmas service in North America, and that was the Christmas of 1619. So when you think back to the establishment of the Virginia colony in 1607 and the Plymouth colony in 1620, there were Lutherans here in North America at the same time. Jensen conducted the Christmas service, but soon after that, the sailors became sick. And one of the greatest scourges of all sailors at that time was scurvy, as a result of a lack of vitamin C and fresh fruits. And this really must have been a very, very debilitating, painful, and finally it became a fatal disease. Fingernails fell out, hair dropped out, even of young men, toenails, the joints gave way, so that a person almost became a bag of bones in the final stages. Finally, you couldn't even walk anymore and could only rest on a bunk bed. Now, most of the sailors died. Rasmus Jansen officiated at the death of these sailors. And finally, on February 20th of 1620, he himself died, and he is buried up there in Port Churchill, Canada. The first Lutheran clergyman to be buried here in the North America. What is particularly amazing is that Captain Jens Munk took two, some say three, of his sailors who lived through the winter, believe it or not. And he took the smallest of these two ships and he sailed back to first to Norway and then to Denmark. And that's how we know about the expedition, because he wrote a book on it, his ship's log, the record that he kept day after day. One entry towards the end of winter, he addressed to his wife, particularly and said that this was it. He said he did not think that he would live through that particular day. But for somehow or other, he survived. Dead sailors lying all over on the ship that he had occupied. Nobody there to bury them. Nobody even strong enough to minister to them. And then he thought he was the only survivor, and all he could do by that time was to crawl on his hands and knees. And he lifted himself up to the ship's railing, and then he was shocked because he saw two people who he thought were either bears or gorillas or something. He found out those were two of his sailors. They did not have sufficient strength to come back on board ship. So they crawled around on the ice and the snow outside of the ship, and they too survived, and those are the three men who sailed these ships back. It must have just looked, one ship they sailed back, it must have looked like a ghost ship. There were no sails left. They had all been battered and beaten in the wind. They did not have any lifeboats. All ropes, everything else, was all shot. And they took that ship, about the size of Columbus, and sailed it back to Norway. It's a miracle that they ever got back, weathering the horrible storms. And Jens Munk, the captain, describes these storms, what horrible gales, thinking that they were just like a cork that was beaten in the Atlantic. But they made it, and this often has been referred to as really one of the earliest settlements, even though most of the people died. Another group that I like to refer to, although there are some who say that they were really not Lutherans, are the Huguenots. I'm sure you've heard of Huguenots, which were the French Protestants, really. It settled in Florida, not in 1619, but these people came as early as the 1560s. Now, this is a very interesting story as far as I'm concerned. Have you been in Jacksonville, Florida? But I bet you weren't down at the seashore in Jacksonville. There you will find, if you walk, I think it's pretty hard to get there by car. If you walk all the way down to the waterfront in Jacksonville, Florida, you will find the remains of Fort Carolina. And it is Fort Carolina, which was primarily built out of wood, of earthen works, instead of building with logs and stone. These French Huguenots built their fort by digging and by heaping up soil. You can still see this, the outline of the fort. You can see almost where the remains are of the captain's home inside that fort. Have you been in St. Augustine? Then you have seen Fort St. Marcos down there, which juts right out, and it looks as defensive as it did when it was built. That was built by the Spanish. And the Spanish just simply hated the French, who were, about 60 miles north of St. Augustine, who are settling in Jacksonville. In Europe, they were constantly fighting during these times. The Spanish against the English, the French then joined them, and they'd get into a new brawl. They'd have their sea battles, perhaps not so often a land battle. But here, France in Jacksonville, Spain in St. Augustine, but what made it much, much worse is the fact that the French were not Catholic French, they were Lutheran French in Jacksonville. And Pedro Menendez, the Spanish captain in St. Augustine, thought that it was bad enough to have Frenchmen that close to his Spanish possession, but think how much worse it was to have Lutherans that close to this Roman Catholic Spanish settlement. So he took his men and they marched. Most of the defenses, even Fort St. Marcos, is facing out to the sea. It's not facing to the rear, to the land. So Pedro Menendez was sharp enough to know that if we go by sea, they'll catch us. So he marched his men the 60 miles north to Jacksonville, and he surprised the French Huguenots and killed almost every Frenchman they could find, and the women and the children were taken back to St. Augustine. And then he put up a sign. There are contemporary artists who drew a picture of this, put a sign on there which said that these were killed not because they were French, but because they were Lutherans. So the old persecution concept of Europe was brought over to America. Then Admiral Coligny of the French fleet heard about this, and he was on his way to give reinforcements and new supplies to the French Huguenots in Jacksonville anyway. When he heard about this, he hurried up, and he carried out some pretty severe vengeance on the Spanish. And he hung most of them, strung them, hanged them from the trees. And underneath those dangling, and again, this is from an artist's drawing, he put the sign that they were executed not because they were Spaniards, but because they were murderers and thieves. There was a seesaw battle going on between the two, but finally the Spanish won, and they expelled all the French Huguenots from Florida, and Spain, Florida then became the possession of the Spanish. Were they Lutheran? We're not really sure. Any non-Catholic was called a Luterano by the Spanish. So they constantly refer to them as Luteranos, not as Huguenots. But I think that if you see that, if you have had a chance to see that part of the country, I think that the warfare between the French Huguenots and the Catholic Spanish becomes much more living. Now, we can also stop at New York, known as New Amsterdam at that particular time. As early as 1611, there are traces of Lutheran people living in New York. At that time, it was a possession of Holland, the Dutch. And New York was called New Amsterdam. Jonas Bronck, for example, this man has always intrigued me, was the son of a Lutheran pastor. And they say of Jonas Bronck that he had the largest library in New Amsterdam, today's New York, in 1638. Peter Stuyvesant, by the way, Bronck, Bronxville, the Bronx, these are all place names that are named after this early Lutheran settlement. Peter Stuyvesant was the governor of New York, and I'm sure you recall hearing stories in your American history courses. He was a man who somehow had lost his leg and had a wooden peg put on there so that the pictures or the drawings you see of him wearing the Dutch pantaloons, and you can always see that peg leg, wooden peg leg. The Dutch did not tolerate any other religion but the Dutch Reformed. So there was a very strong intolerance. Their civil code stated, "No other religion shall be publicly admitted in New Netherland except the Reformed, as it is at present practiced by public authority in the New Netherlands." Or in the United Netherlands, really. Now, this meant that no Catholic, no Jew, no Lutheran ever had an opportunity to worship God according to the dictates of his conscience. And Peter Stuyvesant made sure that these laws were enforced. He fined any clergyman who was audacious enough to conduct a service, $240, which was about the equivalent of a pastor's salary for 1 year. I wonder how many clergymen you'd find conducting a service if they'd forfeit their salary for the entire year. Laymen, for attending the service, had to pay a $60 fine, which was roughly about one quarter year salary. I wonder how many lay people would attend the service today. If they were caught there, they'd have to pay about 3 months, give up 3 months of their salary. Now, by 1653, there were 150 Lutheran families in New York. Imagine that. That's a sizable group, or New Amsterdam, I should say. It wasn't called New York. And in 1653, they petitioned the Lutherans in Old Netherlands to send them a pastor. There was a huge Lutheran church in Old Amsterdam in Europe. And these Lutherans responded. They assumed that since they were tolerated in Old Amsterdam, that certainly the New Amsterdam government would tolerate a Lutheran clergyman. So they sent a man by the name of John Ernst Gutwasser. Anyone here who might try his hand at translating the name Gutwasser? Wasser? Water, good water, yeah. Which is really a good name for a preacher, isn't it? The man who transmits the good water of the gospel. Gutwasser came, and he arrived in July of 1657. Imagine how many years that is before the Revolutionary War. That's 120 years. So he came, and I hope that it will amaze you to know where the Lutheran Church was built. If this is Manhattan Island, the fort stood here. That's the Dutch fort. Wall Street ran across here, and the Lutherans owned this property. Can you imagine a more expensive plot of ground? By the way, this is Broadway. Broadway and Wall. Imagine if you would own a large plot of ground today on the corner of Broadway and Wall in New York City. That's what the Lutherans owned. They had a church built here. This and Wall Street really was a wall, a defense against the Indians. Now, when Gutwasser heard that, Stuyvesant heard that Gutwasser was a Lutheran pastor who was officiating in New Amsterdam, he sent his Dutch policeman out to get him. And the Lutherans heard about this, and they took their pastor, knowing that the gate here was being guarded, took their pastor, put him in a basket, and led him down through the window of the church over the wall where some Lutherans who were living, they were farmers living farther out of the city, were waiting for him, and they took him out into outstate New York. Now, everything went well, but then Gutwasser got sick, and he needed medical attention, so he came back into town in June of 59. You notice it's about a two-year period that he served. Incidentally, also, remember the request for a pastor was sent in 1653. It wasn't until 4 years later that they got their pastor, a vacancy of 4 years in a congregation. Pretty tough. As soon as Stuyvesant heard that Gutwasser was back in town, he sent his police after him again. This time he caught him, put him in handcuffs. There was a ship waiting, going back to New York, and Stuyvesant put Gutwasser on board the ship and sent him back. He was expelled from the colony. And the interesting thing is that he very piously records this, that he deported the Lutheran divine, several prostitutes, and also some additional undesirable characters that had lived in New Amsterdam. And then he writes, "This was necessary for the glory of God, the success of the Reformed religion, and the common quiet peace and harmony of this province." So the Lutherans had lost their pastor, he was expelled, and they were alone again. Finally, in 1664, this is a rather important date for Lutherans in America. In 1664, the British ships come sailing into New York Harbor. They got all their guns trained on the Dutch fort, and they start blasting away until the Dutch say, "We give up." And the English begin taking over New Amsterdam, and 1664 becomes New York. English Governor Richard Nichols takes over. And the Lutherans immediately make a beeline to him and say, "Please grant us religious toleration." And Governor Richard Nichols signs a big proclamation, and he grants religious toleration to these Lutherans, which becomes the first charter of religious liberty in America, granted to this Lutheran congregation. This congregation, by the way, is a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So that when you think in terms of the freedom to worship, freedom of conscience, all these freedoms, they came to America in 1664 with the arrival of the British, with the arrival of the English. And the congregation that suffered this persecution and was willing to stick its neck out, even while Stuyvesant was still the governor of New Amsterdam, but then immediately petitioned for religious toleration, it's called St. Matthew's Lutheran Church of New York today. So I think that we do have a very strong stake in the history of our country. There were also a group of Swedish Lutherans coming to America along the Delaware River. This takes you into the Philadelphia area and then along the Delaware into Wilmington, Delaware, and areas around there. They came for several reasons. Like most of the colonists, the Virginia colony, the Plymouth colony, and others, they came in order to make money for the investors, for the stockholders. But these Lutherans, who spoke Swedish, came also. Part of their charter is to bring the gospel to the American Indians. And the first book translated into any language of an American Indian was translated by one of these Swedish Lutheran missionaries by the name of John Campanius, and the book was Luther's Small Catechism. First book ever to be translated into the language of an American Indian. John Campanius worked among the Indians and also served his own Swedish Lutherans for several years. The governor of New Sweden was a man by the name of Johann Prince. Some records indicate that he weighed 300 pounds. Some say that he weighed 400 pounds. The Indians, who knew him very well, the Swedish Lutherans mixed beautifully with the Indians. They called him, and if you see a picture of him, you knew immediately why, they called him Big Guts. And this is what a 400-pound Swedish Lutheran governor looked like. Now, he tussled. Governor Prince tussled with Peter Stuyvesant. The Swedes, Dutch claimed the Swedish territory down into Philadelphia, and the Swedes defended themselves. But finally, the Dutch won. And they expelled almost all of the Lutheran clergymen out of the Swedish colonies, which really set them back and contributed very, very strongly to the ultimate loss of all of these colonies to the Lutheran Church by about the 1630s and 40s. No Swedish Lutheran churches are in existence anymore. Those that were still in existence have become Episcopalian by that time. Now, if you have had a chance to get to Philadelphia this year or some other time, or if you are planning to go there in the future, by all means look up Gloria Dei Church in Philadelphia. It's way down on the waterfront. This is a very, very historic Lutheran church of the Swedish variety, built in 1700, 75 years before the Revolutionary War. And it is in that church that the first Lutheran clergyman in America was ordained. And oddly enough, this clergyman was a German by the name of Faulkner. Who was ordained by the Swedish Lutherans in Philadelphia to serve the Dutch Lutherans in New York. These people were Dutch. All their records, their language that they used was Dutch, not German. So here was this German, ordained by the Swedes, to serve the Dutch in New York. And I think that to some degree, that typifies the early Lutheran work in America. Now, there was another group that settled near Savannah, Georgia. These are the Salzburgers, a very interesting group of people. They came from, where's Salzburg? Austria. They came from that area of near surrounding Salzburg, Austria. The crime that they had committed was the fact that they had espoused the Lutheran faith in a Catholic country. The Archbishop gave these Salzburgers the ultimatum. You have one of two choices. Get out of Austria or give up your faith. And these Salzburgers were, by and large, farmers. They had been farming the same land in Austria that their grandparents and great-great-grandparents had been farming. Now, what are they going to do? They met together, and there were large numbers of them, not just a little group, thousands of Salzburgers. They met together, and they decided never will they give up their Lutheran faith. So they decided they'd have to give up all their ancestral properties, and they did. This story begins in the 1730s. Governor James Oglethorpe of Georgia invited them, said, if you have no place, come settle near Savannah. I'll give you the land. Others moved into Prussia, Germany today, into the little countries, Lithuania, Estonia, and so forth. They moved all the way up in there, but they had to get out. They were all, or a large number of them, were expelled on April 23rd, 1731. And it is part of that group, the first group that arrived in America in 1734, consisted of only 91 people. But by 1741, 1,200 people had arrived in America alone, and thousands of other people had left Austria. And they were allowed to take only the goods that they could carry. Goethe's Hermann and Dorothea, do you remember ever having read about this? Goethe describes the experiences of these people where the fathers in the family carried the heaviest possessions on their backs. The mothers carried whatever they could. The older boys wheeled a wheelbarrow. The little kids carried their little baskets of possessions. That's all. Whatever they were unable to carry, no trucks, no wagons, no nothing, whatever they could not carry, had to leave, to stay behind. And so these people now built life anew. In Georgia, they established a community which was known as Ebenezer. Which is roughly about 25 miles northwest of Savannah, Georgia. I had a chance to take a look at their little settlement several years ago, and it's very difficult to find. The town, if you're driving in that area, the town you want to look for is called Rincon. If you don't know that, you'll never find it. And if you expect to find something as you do in Perry County, Wittenberg and Altenburg and Frohna and so forth, you'll be horribly disappointed. Because all you will find after you drive through Rincon, which is a very small town in Georgia, almost at the end of this long drive from Savannah, you'll come to a wooded area, and in an opening within that wooded area stands the old Ebenezer Lutheran Church and the parsonage and one additional building. Now, that's all that's left of the old Ebenezer Salzburg settlement. But the church is still in operation. They conduct services there. There's a congregation of 350, 400 communicants. But what a glorious history these people had. During the Revolutionary War, they arrived in 1734 to be exact. The first colonial governor of the state of Georgia was the chairman of the elder board of the Salzburg settlement. His name was John Adam Treutlein. The preachers, incidentally, left Ebenezer because they sided with the British. And the congregation said, good riddance. We're glad you guys are gone. Now we can start building our congregation as a United States congregation without any pro-British tendencies. And Adam Treutlein was one of the chief elders in that congregation. He became governor of Georgia. And the state legislature of Georgia met in Ebenezer. This was really the government of Georgia during the Revolutionary War. The British knew this. And they had to take Ebenezer. And they did, because there were no defenses there in Ebenezer. So they used that church, which is still standing today, as their stable for their cavalry horses, the redcoats. And the back part of the church was used to stack the bacon and other provisions for the British troops. You can still see in the back of the church where they now, after all these years, same building, trustees are painting that inside over again and again and again and again, and here comes that old bacon grease of the British Army from the Revolutionary War seeps through, and it looks as though somebody had thrown a pat of butter on the wall. That's the history that these people have. Today they are still in existence. They are a member of the Lutheran Church in America. Now another large contingent of people arrived in Pennsylvania. And I think that most of the time when we think in terms of Lutheranism, we begin to think about the Pennsylvania Dutch as being perhaps some of the earliest Lutherans. They were not. These Germans settling in Pennsylvania did not come as early as these other glimpses that I gave you. But they were numerically much larger. There was a group of Lutherans also that moved along the Hudson Valley in New York. And Lutheranism began to concentrate and to become rather strong in the Pennsylvania area. But the real man who began to consolidate all this work of early Lutheranism was Muhlenberg. Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, who was born in 1711 and died in 1787, so he just lived through the Revolutionary War. He did more to take a look at Ebenezer, to take a look at the Swedes, to take a look at the Lutherans in New York, to take a look at the all new settlements that were springing up in Pennsylvania and outstate New York, and believed that there ought to be much more rapport between these Lutherans. And so he organizes the first Lutheran organization, the Pennsylvania Ministerium, which was organized in 1748. Now, if you take a look at the organization of the Missouri Synod, it is exactly 99 years before the Missouri Synod. The Pennsylvania Ministerium of 1748 is today a part of the Lutheran Church in America.